Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey. Phippa Preuss is wired for the leap. At 16, she skydived without telling her parents, then learned to find calm mid-air, underwater, and in rooms full of people. That is the person we are meeting, the risk-taker and community maker who later co-founded Living Koko, a Melbourne chocolate company working with small-plot Samoan farmers to turn fair-priced cacao into small-batch chocolate, drinking cacao, and teas. We talked to Phippa about her roots, the leaps that shaped her, and the future she wants on the ground. Phippa Preuss, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited. Looking forward to this conversation.
So are we. We're very excited as well, and we feel very privileged. So let's start at the beginning, your cultural roots, an early picture of home that still sticks in your mind, and the people who kept you steady. Where in Samoa is your family from? And what is one early memory from there that still sticks in your mind today?
My mother's village is Fayusu, which is in the district of Faleata. And my father is from Vailima, both in the island of Upolu. One of my most earliest memories is as kids, when it was really dark, still playing hide and go seek, or like trying to catch each other in the dark. Did you do one of the sun in the spirit? So in the evening time is when, I guess in a lot of our Pacific nations, we all go for walks.
Yes.
The sun's going down. It's a little cooler. So I love those evening walks.
My favorite.
The dogs haven't come out yet, but the people don't have the dogs that are going to attack you yet. But all the people are out walking. And then as it starts to get a little bit darker, me, my brother, sister, and cousins in Vayusu would play hide and go seek. I remember that from when I was 5 years old. And it's just the thrill of being out at night, the thrill of it all.
The thrill of what if there is a stray dog that finds you?
A dog or a ghost?
Right? That's such an islander thing. Hey, a dog or a ghost is about to get you.
Which one is like?
Now, growing up between South Auckland and Samoa, what did moving between those worlds teach you early on?
At times it made me feel like I didn't fit in anywhere. Being Afakasi, maybe my language wasn't as strong as my cousins who had spent their whole lives in Samoa. And it wasn't that anyone had made me feel that way. It's just the thing that you put on yourself as a child. But it also taught me the resilience that we can gather from our youth, the lessons we can gather from our youth that then come through here, like how to be seen, but also to be humble at the same time. There's a fine balance in that. And sometimes in a Western context, we can be too humble that we're never seen, or, we kind of hide ourselves. But I feel like going between the two helped me, find that balance of coming into spaces to share what I have, but also with a humble heart.
I'm wondering, if we met you at the age of 10 or 12, let's say, how would you describe yourself as a child?
Super extroverted with my brothers and sisters, and creative, and I could pick up any item, even, whether it was a pencil or a mop or a salu, a broom, and create stories with it and be so creative with it and dance with it and move with it. And then as soon as someone outside our family walked in, boom, like complete shutdown. this or its fear of being seen by anyone else outside of this, my comfort space.
What then helped you find your voice?
Polynesian dance and the music and the arts. So I was learning classical guitar since I was about 11, 12, and played up it all through into university. And I remember joining a Cook Island group, the Sea Voyagers Cook Island group that used to practice in Mangere in South Auckland on Yates Road. And I joined them as their guitarist. And I remember playing the guitar and going, looking at these incredible dancers, like, and they did, you know, all forms of Polynesian dance. And I thought, what am I doing playing the guitar for? I wouldn't look that pretty. I wouldn't be on stage. And so it kind of gave me another step into, I guess, the performing arts and representing cultures in different ways, our Pacific cultures. But then from there, it was another huge step to go from there then to be able to use voice. So then to be able to speak and be clear about, you know, our values and what we do here. I could dance in front of thousands and with just excitement, and then you would put a microphone in front of me and I would be that 10-year-old that just shuts down. So it's just been a constant journey of getting out of my own way, I guess. Yeah, and reminding myself that these are the growing pains of being an adult, you know, that real uncomfortableness and how to sit in it. Where I think when you're a child, a lot of the growing pains, you know, they are mentally, obviously, and spiritually, but they also represent themselves. So physically, you know, yeah. I'm rubbing my nephew's legs as his shins and bones are growing, where for us as adults, we're almost like rubbing our hearts and trying to rub our lungs and get our breath back as we're trying to take a growth spurt in different ways.
Yeah, that we're so lucky. Like across the Pacific, the cultural performance space is such a very sacred but also transformative space for us as well. We learn so much of ourselves and find so much of ourselves that then go on to define or help kind of contribute to who and what we become. So I think we're very fortunate in that way to be able to have those things at our fingertips.
When a lot of our songs and dances are the personification of nature,
right?
Yeah, when we get to dance and we get to move, we're literally moving as one with the universe. Like the va between us and the trees and the space between us and the Hmong and the mountains all of a sudden becomes so small because we're all one in this movement or in this rhythm together. So, you know, I think we're so blessed that we can almost like, you know, with the starting of the beats or the movement of our hands, the softness of our hands, or however our bodies start to personify, we become nature. We're always nature, but I think it's the fastest way of being reminded.
Gosh, I just got goosebumps because I think like when we talk about privilege and how much privilege we have or don't have, I think that is definitely a privilege that we have as Pacific Islanders and how in touch we are still with our culture and being one with nature through parts of our culture that we still practice today. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's just, I mean, I could spend, it'd be a whole nother episode listening to us talk about this. So tell me about Patu. Yeah, Patu. Now, like many Pacific Islander families, it takes a community to raise us, you know, to raise children, to raise families. Who was influential in your upbringing and what values from them are still with you now?
I would say my mom. Actually, my mom and dad and all their siblings, so all my aunties and uncles, as we're getting older and I'm seeing a lot of our elders passing for various reasons, you know, it's such a huge time of reflection for ourselves of, you know, what huge influences they were within our lives. My mom's brothers shared with me their love of music. You know, one of the reasons why I just loved playing the guitar. They had their band, the Hollyoaks and Samoa, and they were really like quite a famous band that toured.
Oh my gosh.
My grandfather, who started the first marching band in Samoa, the Fayusu marching band, and his name was Laudu John Sisole Stanley. And, you know, his love for community, his community development practitioner mind, you know, the things that we do naturally and with ease that you know, in Australia, you can do a course on. But, you know, it should, in our communities, it's intuitive, and it's just actually how we move in our spaces. But then also my mother's sister and my dad's sister, who are just powerhouse women. They have businesses, they have high titles, chief titles, they don't take any crap, you know, they're fully in their auntie space. but they're also the people that, you know, probably when I was younger, I was just so scared of. Because they're also the ones that are, you know, publicly disciplining us. we'll call it guiding. Publicly guiding us, that their ways of sharing knowledge and passing things down isn't the idealistic way that we see on movies like Moana. It's keeping us in line, because you know that's how they learned as well. And I think that's had a huge influence on me too. Like it reminds me to be humble.
Where would we be without those aunties, huh? They're so
influencers with 2 million followers.
No shame. Oh, that's so funny. We well and truly did. Yeah.
I'm grateful for it. Grateful for it.
Hashtag blessed, highly favored, all the things. Now, Phiphe, your pathway to business came through community cultural development, dance, and long stretches teaching scuba diving. Now, those spaces shaped how you hold people, time, and pressure. Let's unpack some of those things that you carried forward with you. So firstly, what pulled you into community arts and dance in the first place?
I think I went through a huge period of depression here in Melbourne. It was very hard to find, for me at the time, I think also because I was in a very dark space, a very shadowy space, it was very hard to find true, real connection, soft connection. You know, the people I was pulling into my friend group were similar to me, and I wasn't in a very good mental health headspace. I remember at that time reflecting on, like, you know, when was the last time I was confident? When was the last time that I felt happy and comfortable being seen? And I think that reflection went back to things like Polyfest, you know, the community of coming together in New Zealand and learning music, arts. It was almost like me thinking to myself, well, if I could do it back then, I could do it now.
Right.
You know, if I was that happy and that connected with myself and in my body instead of in my head and the darkness, then I can get back to that space. So I went back to training myself in Polynesian dance. Mm-hmm. I was also going through a time where I think the depression came on because I had had an accident. I couldn't use my hands anymore. I couldn't type anymore on the computer. So working in finance and in the corporate spaces where I had been working, all of a sudden that career path had disappeared, which was a blessing. Yeah. And all I remember is thinking is, well, I can still use my hips, you know, and I can still move my body. I just can't sit in the spaces that I used to. And so I trained myself to back in the ways that we trained in New Zealand and back home in the islands, and started a Polynesian dance group. Well, supported a Polynesian dance group that had already begun called Nuhalani, and then became one of the co-directors of it, which grew into a dance school. So it was a dance group that ended up being a huge dance school in Melbourne that taught several forms of Polynesian dance and also had a performance team. But I think it was just seeing how our families moved and grew community with the most simplest tasks. You know, I think sometimes we overcomplicate it and then you realize, oh, community is showing as the tea towel service. It's showing up to the house, or it's giving someone a call because they're on your mind and you just want to check in with them. You know, it's the things that we probably don't do as much of nowadays with messaging and things like that, but showing up to the community events and being present and doing what you can. Yeah.
It's those small things, right? Like it's like asking someone if they want a cup of tea or if they're hungry and you make something for them. What has stayed with you from doing that work? Would you say that you still kind of bring with you into the work that you're doing now from those days?
Oh, yeah. When we're back home visiting the plantation owners, the farmers, you know you don't show up empty-handed, you know? You show it with the food, you show it, and you don't expect to be staying for long. You just pop in and you're coming with your humble heart. Also, when people come to visit, you know that you're going to have, like, honestly, we totally notice when we show up to someone's house and they don't offer us a cup of tea.
1,000 criminal. Criminal is what I'm.
I think I've been here half an hour and I haven't got my tea.
Literally, I'm like, I'm sorry, I've been here for 5 minutes, straight to jail. You haven't offered me tea.
And why is your kid there and not offered? Why haven't they offered? Child. But yeah, simple things like that. That's the, I guess, also just understanding with the communities that we work with or connect with, where everyone is at, but also taking the time to check in with the deeper talanoa and conversation, and also making sure that we don't give fire to some of the shadows that come up within the community. You know, be there to listen to people if they want to vent, but don't add to the gossip.
Yeah, right.
If it's someone's true feelings about a situation, then you know, diving deeper into it and understanding where those feelings come from is a great way of unpacking with each other. But what I've definitely brought forward is trying not to be the one that adds to the gossip, trying to be the positive side to it.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mocky. As a scuba instructor, I'm wondering what initially brought you to the ocean and what did the ocean teach you in those depths?
What brought me to the ocean was my fear of the ocean.
Wow.
There was a year that I realized I had probably been in relationships that were stifling my growth and that I needed to lean into things that were really uncomfortable. And I went away on a trip and someone sitting across from a table said, I'm about to do my dive instructor course or my first dive course. And I said, what time tomorrow? I'm going to be there. I didn't think I could even swim. I had such a fear of the water. I would hyperventilate when I got anywhere past like my mouth, when I felt like the water was going to go over my head. So it was me really trying to face that fear and build my relationship with the Moana. The more I dived, the more I saw how us as humans were taking her for granted, the amount of rubbish that was, that I would pick up through dives, the amount of plastic and things like that. So then continuing my courses and moving into being a dive instructor, on their very last dive, everyone would be given a little net and everyone would be picking up rubbish as we were diving, just trying to clean up our waterways. When you're underwater, the only thing you can hear is your breath. You know, you may be able to hear a boat that passes from a distance. And sometimes if you're lucky, you'll hear the fish eating the coral. But besides that, it's the depth and it's your own thoughts. So when you go down with the scattered and a negative mind or a spiraling mind, you can see it in the way people breathe. If people are diving and their breath is quite high up in their chest, it's not down in their belly, it's high up in their chest, and there's just this long stream of bubbles that keeps coming out of their mouth, which means that they're not actually getting the oxygen that they need. They're like, so they're breathing very short breaths and very high out. When you're breathing through a regulator, which is the part that you put in your mouth, it's air on demand. So it's not like breathing up on the earth where, you know, air is all around us. You take a breath in and it's going to come straight in. When you breathe out a regulator, there's almost like a millisecond of a pause before that breath comes in. And when you're hyperventilating, that can create even more panic. So when your breath is short, when your mind is spiraling, when you've got issues on land that because you're in the quiet are going to be extremely loud, people's mental health can spiral. So taking people down 10 meters or even to 5 meters, sometimes I would take half an hour just to get one person down. And I would feel their hands gripping on me as they were, you know, firstly doing probably the most foreign thing they've ever done in their life, breathing underwater, but also that they're like the volume of what's going on in their head and the foreign way of receiving air, like everything is working against them. So I used to love it because once you got someone into a space where they were breathing deeply and slowly and their heart rate was lowering and they started to see all the beauty that was around them, you realize that they've tapped into a, you know, a tool or they've tapped into a natural resource that is there from there that can actually support their mental health. Mm-hmm. And if it's supporting their mental health, by the end of their third or fourth dive with me, they so want to be there to clean her up. So that if this Moana has given to them, that they want to give back in however they can. And so I never used to see it as, yes, I was teaching people scuba diving, but I was also teaching them about their relationship with the Moana and also themselves.
Is that something you still do today?
And I still dive. I still dive a lot. I haven't taught in a couple of years since living Koko took over my life.
But
I'm still diving, as much as I can. And I'm always at the Moana at least 2 to 3 times a week. So
now let's talk Living Koko. The cacao company you co-founded with Glenn, your partner in life and business, to create real markets for Samoan cacao and growers at the to keep them at the center. Now, from the very beginning, your family's connection to cacao runs deep. When did you first realize it was something you wanted to carry forward?
I don't know if it was a conscious definite decision of this is what I want to carry forward. I think it happened in such a gradual way that it was happening before I realized it was happening. you know, sometimes things land in your lap and you're like, oh, it's working. Oh, okay, we'll keep doing this and we'll keep doing this and we keep doing this. And then you're so far into it that you look back and you're like, oh yeah, okay, this is a business. And we've held onto our values the whole way through. And now we just need to, you know, put it out into the world or, you know, really double down on it and feel comfortable talking about it. So I think it took a little while, the gradual process of, and I think because I was learning along the way, you know, it's running a small business is also learning in real time and learning on your own money. Very different from when you work in corporate spaces. We're like, oh, we didn't make budget and we spent a whole bunch of money that wasn't ours, but that's okay. We're going to take a holiday. You know, it's so different when you're in small business. You're like, oh, we didn't make any money and we spent all this money and there's no sick leave and no holiday. Yeah, such a different kind of lay of the land.
Your grandfather helped create the Laffy 7 cacao bean. How has that story guided your choices?
Yes, he used to work for WesTech, and during his time at WesTech, with another gentleman created the Laffy 7. Mm-hmm. It's I think it's made me see cacao in a very different way. When we walk through some of the plantations, because a lot of the older farmers remember my grandfather, or you know, they were kids when Papa was working closely with their parents. So when they connect with us and when we're on their plantations, they're excited to show us the Laffy 7 trees that they still have there. And so when me and Mama there, we're like, oh, it feels like what's Ainga. It feels like we're being reintroduced to family we haven't seen in a long time.
So special.
Yeah, it is really special. But also just the aloha that our community had for Papa, for what he did within not only the music and the arts in Faiusu, but also in the koko space. It reminds me of how much respect and weight your surname and your lineage can hold in Pacific spaces, how much people are remembered back home. Mm. You know, I think sometimes in cities, don't get me wrong, I love being anonymous sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, there's such an incredible freedom with also being anonymous. But then you go home and, you know, there's a whole lineage that you are stepping through to represent and hearing people's stories with Papa and how much they had, he had touched their lives, made me realize that what we were taking on was also a huge responsibility. You know, it was the continuation of his legacy and his story that was becoming our stories. And there were moments where I wasn't sure if I was ready for that. But, you know, that was just me getting in my own way again.
Was there a particular moment where you felt, oh, I'm ready? Maybe a situation or something that had happened that you felt like, oh, no, I'm meant to do this?
I don't know if there was an exact moment, but I can feel as the years go on, my head being held high. You know, I'm walking into the space and knowing, you know, higher but humble. Higher with a humble heart. Like this, like yes, this the whole way.
Up and down. Always with the humble heart. Always with the humble heart. And for Samoan communities, or maybe just broadly Pacific Islander communities, beyond being a crop, what does cacao hold spiritually or communally?
I think growing up, cacao has always been the symbol of service. You know, when we say we walk into a house and we expect that
a cup of tea
comes out, the tea. Yeah. You know, in Samoa, growing up, it was always the cacao. Like, it was always kuku Samoa. It was, and to know how hard it is to, how much time, energy, hand strength, but to pound the cacao, but also to grow the cacao in your backyard and to ferment and dry it, like the journey of that cacao to the table, just so it shows the amount of service that we have, not only to our lands, but also to each other.
For Pacific Islanders eyeing cacao or chocolate growers, makers, small brands, what is the real talk you wish someone may have given you at the start that would have, that you could now impart to those people? One do and one don't.
If you've never run a business before, you know, surround yourself with like-minded people. Go to networking events, even outside of our cultural spaces. You'd be amazed at the wisdom that other business owners are willing to share with you. Don't get triggered by their wisdom. You know, release the ego and take the notes and study, listen to the podcasts. I think when we first started this business, I didn't know anyone in the cacao and chocolate space to start with. And I didn't even know anyone who was running a food business like this, or even a business. I didn't really know anyone that was running a business. So podcasts became my new best friends. You know, I would listen to that while I was making the chocolate. So educate yourself as much as possible, but also be open to the wisdom of people who've been there before. What not to do, except that you don't know everything. Don't get blinded by your own ego and think that you have all the answers, or you're not willing to bring in answers from others. And don't be shy to ask the questions that seem like they could be the dumbest or the silliest. You'd be surprised who else wants to hear that answer.
Having shared your story with us today, what is one thing or one lesson or something that listeners may have that you wish that they take from your story? What is that one thing they can leave with?
I think when you've heard like some of the really random things that I've done within my life, like from classical guitar teacher to scuba diving instructor to business owner to running music festivals, that, you know, the sky's the limit. You just need to get out of your own way and turn that nervousness into an anxiety. Remind yourself that it's actually excitement and just your growing pains and learning.
Afipe, thank you so much. You've turned courage into practice and chocolate into a circle where everyone eats. What you build isn't just a product. It's a slower conversation, a steadier future, and a hand held out to the next maker. Thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing this with us. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Wendy Mockey. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
This story was produced and hosted on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people.